Service, National Radio Club.
Welcome to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service for March 2009. This is issue number 288. If you'd like to write to us, the address of the DX Audio Service is 706 McKenzie Drive, Lima, Ohio, 45805-1835. Telephone number is 360-382-1957. Email is sales, S-A-L-E-S, at nrcdxas.org. A subscription to the DX Audio Service for U.S. Canadian members is $28. To Europe and elsewhere, it's $40. Tapes are sent via first-class mail, and you keep your cassettes. To subscribe or renew, make a check payable to the National Radio Club Incorporated and send them to me at the address that I just mentioned, or log on to our website at www.nrcdxas.org and sign up using our PayPal credit card system. You can also sign up to EDXN and get your DX audio service on your computer or iPod player in stereo. A subscription to EDXN is only $15. Just point your browser to http://www.e-dxn.com and subscribe online with our PayPal credit card system. Or contact Wayne Heinen at Post Office Box 473-251, Aurora, Colorado 80047-3251 if you want to pay by check. Well, it's our March edition. Next month is our anniversary, and I think John Bowker has been in my office reading some of my notes, because on our next edition, I was going to ask all our members to call in on the Musings line and just tell a little bit about themselves and perhaps a reintroduction to how they got into the hobby. We've got a lot of members who have been with us since day one, which was April of 1985, and we have a few that just recently joined. So it might be nice just to find out a little bit about each other and see what we do for a living, for a hobby, things we like to do in life, you know, just kind of talk a little bit about ourselves for a change on the next edition of the DX Audio Service. I'll open up the Musings line a little longer so that you have a chance to talk. But right now, Bill Hale is in the next studio, and he's jumping up and down, waving his arms frantically, which means either it's time for the AM switch or there's a 747 about to land in my driveway. Here's Bill Hale.
This is the AM Switch.
Thanks, Fred, and welcome everyone to the March 2009 edition of AM Switch for the DX Audio Service. First of all, as always, let's jump right into the call letter changes. 740, the former WQTM in Orlando, Florida, has taken up the new call of WYGM. 820 in Largo, Florida, WMGG is now WWBA. There's been a call letter switcheroo there in the Tampa-St. Pete area, and we'll get to more call changes later. A new station not yet on the air has moved from Dillon, Montana to Jerome, Idaho. At least a construction permit has moved down that way. And they've taken up the call of KDIL. Also on 940 in Hudsonville, Michigan, WHIT is now known as WCSY. 1040 WWBA, Pinellas Park, Florida is now WHBO. On 1080 in Cannonsburg, Kentucky, the former WOKT now IDs as WYHY. 1110 WOKU, Hurricane, West Virginia is now known as WIHY. 1310 WQAH, Priceville, Alabama, their stationery now reads WKZD. 1390 KKSN, Salem, Oregon, goes by the call of KVXX. 1400, the old WMJQ in Middletown, New York, now IDs as WYNY. This, by the way, is an unbuilt construction permit, as is the station I mentioned before in Ontario, New York. 1400 WSTK in Jacksonville, North Carolina, they're now known as WAVQ. 1410 KUHL, Lompoc, California, their new call is KSMA. KINF 1440 in Santa Maria, California, has changed to KUHL. A new station not yet on in Brooklet, Georgia, their call WQQT. Now, as I mentioned, we had some call letter swaps in the St. Pete, Tampa area, and here's another one of them. On 1470, WHBO in Dunedin, Florida, took the call of WWBA on February 2nd, but then on February 10th, they changed from WWBA to WMGG, swapping there with the 1040 station. 1480 WSRC Fair Bluff, North Carolina is now WWKO. A new station not yet on in Silt, Colorado, KNAM is their call. And 1550 WTUX in Madison, Wisconsin has returned to their original call of WHIT. Well, construction permits on the air during the past month. 930 WSFZ, Jackson, Mississippi, a construction permit for U2, that's directional nighttime only, 3,800 watts daytime, 3,100 watts at night is on. They have relocated to the WOAD 1300 single tower site and added two additional towers to accommodate their nighttime pattern. Since WOAD's tower is 415 feet compared to WSFV's former towers of less than 300, they are required to reduce that power accordingly. They were 5,000 day and night. 1130 KTMR, the former station in Edna, Texas, has made the move to Converse, which is a suburb of San Antonio. They're on with 25,000 watts daytime only directional from a new three-tower site. The pattern is kidney-shaped with the main null headed to the northeast. The null is headed to the northeast. Got it? I've had questions about that before. The null is protecting Shreveport, of course, and the new format is business talk. On 1140, KLTK Centerton, Arkansas, has made the move from Southwest City, Missouri, and they're now on with 700 watts daytime only non-directional. A couple of stations on 1200 have increased their power recently, one of which is WKOX Newton, Massachusetts. Their construction permit for 50,000 watts day and night with two different patterns is on. They added a tower to the former two, and they've also made a city of license change from Framingham. Both patterns are huge balloons of power to the northeast. Also on 1200 KFNW, West Fargo, North Dakota, their construction permit for U4, 50,000 watts daytime, 13,000 watts at night is on. They added a tower to what they were using for their daytime pattern, for now a total of four, to produce a circular nighttime pattern headed due north, save for a small blip to the south. No threat to WOAI, I'm sure, as they, WOAI, barely make it here to the Dallas area at night. 1250 KCST Florence, Oregon, they're now on with 900 watts daytime, 37 watts at night, non-directional, moving to a new tower. 1260 WIYD Palatka, Florida, their construction permit for 400 watts daytime, 135 watts at night, all non-directional is on, relocating the transmitter to the tower of co-owned WPLK 800. This change, besides reducing both day and night power levels, eliminates WIYD's nighttime directional pattern. 1270 WQKR, Portland, Tennessee, their CP for 500 daytime watts, 29 watts at night, two patterns is on, that's a U4, and they've added night power. 1320 WBOB Jacksonville, Florida, their construction permit for U2, 50,000 watts days, 5,000 watts at night, is now on the air. 1330 WRCA Watertown, Massachusetts, their CP for 25,000 watts days, 17,000 watts at night, two different patterns, our designation, U4. They're on from five towers using 5 day, 4 at night. Both new patterns shoot all the power out over the Atlantic Ocean. This is also a city of license change from Waltham, Mass. 1400 WSTK Jacksonville, North Carolina was heard with what sounded like a regular schedule, including ABC News. The license facilities are 1,000 watts day and night, non-directional, and what we had been calling previously as possibly on with a regular schedule, we'll call it on. 1480 WTLO Corbin, Kentucky, moving from Somerset, is now on with 1,000 watts daytime, 27 watts at night. Adding that night service, they're all non-directional. 1490 KWAC Bakersfield, California, their construction permit for U1, 640 watts day and night is on, relocating to the KGEO 1230 tower. Since KGEO's tower is almost twice as tall as the former KWAC tower, in order to maintain the same coverage area, they're required to reduce the power from the former 1,000 watts day and night. Also on 1490 WACM Springfield, West Springfield, Massachusetts, they've applied and is on now with an STA, which is a special temporary authority, 1,000 watts day 850 watts at night. And 1600 WKZK North Augusta, South Carolina, their CP for 4,000 watts during the day, 27 watts at night, all non-directional. They've added that night service. Well, some actions during the past month. KMLB 540, Monroe, Louisiana. They've been granted 4,000 watts days and 26 watts at night, non-directional, doing away with their daytime and nighttime patterns. 670 KMZQ, Las Vegas, Nevada. An STA has been granted for 600 watts day and night, using two patterns. 910 WGTO, Cassopolis, Michigan. A CP has been granted for U4, 5,700 watts during the day, 35 watts at night. Here's that station on 940 that's moving from Dillon, Montana to Jerome, Idaho, KDIL. A CP has been granted to move with 1,000 watts daytime, 250 watts at night, U4, from a two-tower site. 960 WSVU, North Palm Beach, Florida. CP has been granted for 2,500 watts during the day, 1,400 watts at night, U4. They'll be adding a tower to their standing 2 for the daytime power increase. The day pattern has changed to direct more of the signal to the northeast and very little to the south. 1270 WSPR, Springfield, Massachusetts. An STA has been granted for 1,000 watts daytime, 350 watts at night, non-directional, relocating to the WACM 1490 tower. 1340 WSOY, Decatur, Illinois, a CP has been granted to move to the tower of co-owned WDZ 1050 due to the fact that WDZ's tower is approximately half as tall as WSOI's. Coverage will be decreased, especially to the north, according to coverage maps in the application. 1470 WKCK, Orocovis, Puerto Rico. A CP has been granted for 2,400 watts during the day, 2,500 watts at night, using two patterns. 1550 WHIT, Madison, Wisconsin. An STA has been granted for D1, 1,250 watts during the day, nothing at night, or as the application states, and we quote, to operate its daytime directional antenna system with parameters at variance is also to operate non-directionally during daytime hours at a power level of 1.25 kilowatts, which is 25% of the licensed daytime directional power, using one tower of the WHIT antenna system to facilitate the replacement of the towers and antenna coupling units and modifications to the remainder of the WHIT phasing system. So they're on the air with 1,250 watts non-directional, and that's, of course, a daytime-only station. Some license cancellations and call letters deleted this past month, all in Canada. CBRU 1270 in Squamish, B.C. has been replaced by an FM station. Also replaced by an FMer, CBGA 7 on 1340 in St. Anne-de-Monts in Quebec, and 1490 CFWB Campbell River, British Columbia, is now gone. Some more translator actions. AM on FM translators. 1040 KGGR in Dallas is being heard on K273BJ 102.5 in Dallas. 1420 WVJS Owensboro, Kentucky is being heard on W263BG 100.5. And 1570 WSCO Appleton, Wisconsin is being heard on W214BT 90.7. Some more migrations to the FM dial. 630 CHLT in Sherbrooke, Quebec has made the switch to 102.1 with 5.8 kilowatts. That station had been on the air since 1937. And 1230 CFLN Goose Bay, Labrador applies to move to 97.9 with 1,000 watts at 25.4 meters in height. This proposal includes CFLN's relay of CFLW 1340 in Wabush, and they want to move to 94.7 with 1 kilowatt at minus 26.4 meters MSL. Application for new stations, 1450, a new station in Hilo, Hawaii, is applied for U4, 5,000 watts day and night. That's correct. On that local channel. And applications that have been dismissed, 1460 CJOY Guelph, Ontario wanted to move to FM, but the CRTC has denied that move. Finally, cancellations and call letters deleted in the U.S., a station that has been off for quite some time, and it finally took notice in the FCC database, 1700 WJCC down in Miami Springs, and it's finally official, so you can officially scratch them out of your logs. Some other items from here and there reported as on the air, WCHQ 960 Quebra Diaz, Puerto Rico, and WHWH 1350 in Princeton, New Jersey. They call themselves Radio TED with a jazz format. Reported as off this past month, WDMV 700 Walkersville, Maryland, WMTC 730 Van Cleve, Kentucky, WBKZ 880 Jefferson, Georgia, after a fire hit its studio. Also off, WDYT 1220 Kings Mountain, North Carolina, WMOU 1230 Berlin, New Hampshire, WTKI 1450 Huntsville, Alabama, WDPT 1490 Decatur, Alabama, WTRI 1520 Brunswick, New Jersey, and WRPM 1530 Poplarville, Mississippi. A couple of fines to report. $4,000 for public inspection file violations against WWII 720, Shiremanstown, Pennsylvania. $6,000 to KDKA 1020, Pittsburgh, for violating rules concerning a contest. $9,000 for WLRM 1380, Millington, Tennessee, for public file violation. And $14,000 to the licensee of now-deleted WQMA 1520, Marks, Mississippi, for willful and repeated violations of the FCC rules regarding tower base enclosures, or lack thereof. Well, my thanks go out to Sean Axelrod, Tony Fitzherbert, Mike Hardister, Wayne Heinen, Dean McIntyre, and Dave Schmidt for items used this month. Now I turn the microphone over to John Bowker with the next edition of Radio Remembers, as I call it. John?
National Radio Club.
Well, thanks very much, Bill Hale, and hello, everybody. Say, you know, it's been fun this past month. We heard from a couple of our listeners. Ernie up in New York suggested I should tell you what radio stations I've been on. I can do that about on one hand, Ernie, my friend. Another fellow wrote me an email and said, don't we ever introduce ourselves and what we've been doing? He had missed what I had put out in 1987 on the audio service I get. But anyway, I'll be glad to do that for just a couple of minutes. You have to understand that my real career was on the technical side of broadcasting. I had been hired by RCA's Sarnoff Laboratories in 1953 to help in the research that led to the NTSC color system that we've all enjoyed, more or less, right up until this present year when the new digital system is taking over, come to think of it. Gosh darn it. But weekends, while I was working at the Sarnoff Labs, I had time to play at WHWH. I was the morning man on Saturday mornings, and that was a ball. And WWPH, just across town. I hand-built that FM station, and what a hassle to get my transmitter accepted by the FCC. Multiple trips to Columbia, Maryland, their test center, I can tell you. And then later I went with WBUD in Trenton as a big band program host. That's pretty formal sounding, isn't it? And wound up at WIMG for 2.5 years. That's again in the Trenton area. Until WIMG was sold. I was instructed one Sunday night by telephone to sign the station off the air when I got through doing whatever it was. And I kid you not, I was told, leave the front door key under the mat. And I did that. None of our technical or air staff ever met anyone from the new owners. But somehow, Johnny Morris and his people got that WIMG up and running the very next day. I got my start in Burlington, Vermont, come to think of it, on WCAX 620. That was in 1946, before they changed call letters and networks and everything else. Then I built the Part 15 AM station at Middlebury College, and later went back to build WRMC, which is now 6 kilowatts. And, of course, I was on those stations from their very beginning. And then in 1976, with the color system research pretty well completed, I spent a very short time at KNBR in San Francisco doing some news work there, and then came back to RCA and took over the Frequency Bureau as the director. So my last dozen years with RCA was in charge of all of their radio licenses, and that included, ship-to-shore, satellite, point-to-point microwave communications licenses, and all the radio and TV stations licensed to the National Broadcasting Company. And then when RCA was sold to General Electric in 1987, I moved copies of all my files to my home and for the next 4 years operated my own company, helping the new owners of all those licenses that had been dispersed by GE. And then Linda retired in 1991, we bought a motorhome, and we were never heard from again. Well, no, wait, that isn't quite true, Fred. Actually, you know, by then I'd been working for you on the audio service for 5 or 6 years, hadn't I? The pay wasn't very good and still isn't, but I'm kidding, of course. That's no pay at all. So there's no telling how long I'll be continuing the travelogue here, but at least now you know where I was coming from. But now, let's see. It's time to get back with the travelogue and get out some of our mini-discs and cassettes ready to go. Another of the people we heard from was Tim Hendel. Hi, Tim. Haven't talked to you in, a long time, I guess, since we were both in Tennessee back at a convention years and years ago. A lot of fun. And Tim asked if I had been in Dubuque, and if so, had I recorded the stations out there? And as I love to ask people who ask a question like that, my heaven's sakes, are frogs waterproof? By the way, frogs are not waterproof. But anyway, yeah, no, we've been in Dubuque. And why don't we start with the station that signed on first in 1941. And by the way, I know the internet says they signed on in May of 1980. That's not true. They were on the air just before World War II started. We take you now to 1370 in Dubuque, Iowa, as we begin the march. 2009, good heavens, DX Audio Service Travelogue.
Go until tomorrow afternoon for the Hall of Famer Harry Carey, Ron Santo, and our engineer Tony Sibilla. I'm Tom Brenneman saying thanks so much for being with us, and so long, everybody.
Our time now is coming up on 5 minutes past 5 o'clock. You're listening to Full Service Radio, KDTH in Dubuque, and we'll take a check on local news in just a moment. This is Full Service Radio, 1370 KDTH, Dubuque.
Now, let me remind you once again, I should have said this at the very beginning of today's segment, and that is, these are all old station breaks. They're not one of them that's more recent than 25 years, closer to 30 years in a few cases. And as we move across town, we pick up 1490 in Dubuque.
This is Dubuque's oldie station, AM 1490, WDBQ Dubuque.
Yes, very nice. Now, to wrap up my brief chat with Tim, we're going to give you a station now at 1170 on the dial in Vernon, Connecticut.
WRTT. More music, more local news, and more of what's happening in your community. AM 1170, WRTT, Vernon.
And you may be wondering why I would jump all the way east to Connecticut after that. Well, Tim Hendel knows the game I'm playing. At least, I believe he does. And Tim, I hope you get the significance of that. Just having fun. These are some of the old station breaks, and I find these on the tape and I think, hey, wait a minute, WRTT, I got to play that for Tim. We're going to continue now to the northeast out of Vernon, Connecticut. We come to the city of Worcester, and I had my dial set at 1440, expecting to hear the fill-in for WEEI. The station was WVEI, I thought, and I was wrong.
From the heart of the Commonwealth, news and information when you need it. This is 14 WFTQ Worcester. It's 5 o'clock.
ABC News, I'm John Grimes.
And as we go about 20 miles to the east, leading us toward the city of Boston, we come to another station that's enjoyed a change of frequency, a change of power, a change of format, a change of call sign, and what did I skip? Oh, City of License.
Metro West, WTTP, Touch 1060. First, it's WTTP SportsScope with your sports comments and questions. Then this afternoon at 3:45, we have NFL football, Kansas City, Denver. All for you, exclusively from Metro West, this weekend and every weekend, from Touch 1060, WTTP.
WTTP, Natick, Framingham, Boston's talk of the suburbs.
From ABC News, I'm Bob Windsor.
Now, I know many of you have done the same sort of thing that Linda and I did for 10 years in our motorhome, going around the countryside, making a recording of stations as you go. And so often you have to struggle to get them to ID the station. It seems like it's a personal affront almost. But then you come to a station like this one, just north of the city of Boston. Such a nice, clean, timely station break.
Details from AM 98. This is WCAP Lowell. It's 2 o'clock.
Direct from ABC News.
Now this next ID goes way back, 1330 in Waltham, Massachusetts. And do I want an update on this? Absolutely not. You see, one of the things I used to do as director of the RCA Frequency Bureau was keep certain call signs available for NBC and RCA stations, like WRCA, that came out after I left. WRCV, we kept that one in Philadelphia, finally used it on Channel 3 television, and others. But within a month of the time that RCA was sold to General Electric, some interest in Waltham, Massachusetts applied for and immediately could get WRCA for their station in Waltham. It was heartbreaking. I can laugh about it now, but I sure couldn't then. Oh, and it's also a Spanish-speaking station now. Oh, that's fine, but not what RCA had in mind for its call letters, I'm sure.
It is 3 o'clock. We're Boston Country, 1330 WDLW Waltham, a broadcast service of the Acton Corporation.
Okay, fooling around time a little bit. You know, I probably made the same mistake this gal's about to make, but at least I wasn't on a major market metro station to do it.
And Nat King Cole, right here on the new AM 1510, WMRE, the memory station. It is now 3 o'clock.
I'm Joe McMillan with WMRE Headlines on the new AM 1510. WMRE, Boston.
Okay, enough from Boston. Say, I want to go back to something I said right at the beginning. Had to do with my work in Trenton, New Jersey on WBUD. You're going to hear a station break by my boss. Well, everybody's boss at WBUD. And we always used to say, hey, how could we get him to sort of recognize that this is just dragging on interminably? And the station break you're going to hear, it turns out the fellow who gives the time and goes into the news was criticized by the boss for almost stepping. He said, hey, you almost stepped on me.
A proud tradition in a proud region. WBUD, 1260 from Trenton.
It's 3 o'clock.
NBC News, I'm Mike Moss.
And here's an ID you won't hear anymore from the middle 1970s, even if you live in Oak Park, Illinois.
As we go merrily on our way towards the news, and a little bit of nonsense like Chip Talk after that. But musically, that's about it for this afternoon. Hope you've enjoyed. This is WNWI 1080 on your dial from Valparaiso. Indiana federal temperature, 19 degrees.
And how many remember the last sounds we ever heard from this next station was the sound of waves crashing on the shore?
Keeping you in touch for play-by-play coverage of the 84 Rose Bowl. This is AM 1000, WCFL Chicago, 4 o'clock.
Mutual News via satellite. I'm Dave Curran.
And as a child, did I have trouble picking up WCFL at night? Not in the least, because this next station was a daytimer 25 miles from my bedroom.
This is HB 10, WHWB, AM 1000, Rutland, Vermont, your weather station.
Well, okay, it's been a lot of fun today. I see Fred in the other room, though. He's reaching for that switch labeled Bowker off, Durenberger on. And that I don't even have to look at the clock when I see him doing that. I know what he means. Oh, boy, but we've been up and down the dial today all the way from, what, about 200 to 545? Oh, you don't remember those days. Well, we didn't get back quite to those days in the early 20s when the dial was from 200 to 545 approximately. But I tell you why I mention it. Mark Durenberger today is going to start a whole new series telling us how the AM radio dial got developed the way it is. So have a real good month. I'll be back with you in about 30 days from Florida. Mark, it's all yours, sir.
National Radio Club.
Thank you, John. Today, we embark on an extensive and ambitious project to chronicle the development of the early AM radio band in the United States. During coming months, we're going to track these two ways for you. First, how the broadcast frequencies were developed, looking at government regulations and their impact on stations. In our second series, we'll put the spotlight on individual Clear Channel stations to see how they developed their facilities during those formative years. The scope of this project spans the time period from the early 1920s through the massive dial switch of 1941 and the changes made 40 years later at the Rio Agreement. We're aided in the project by trade magazine articles and by scholarly research from historians we'll cite as we move through this massive mess of data. And through this series, we want to acknowledge, among many others, the excellent work of Thomas H. White in his treatise Building the AM Broadcast Band. Broadcasting as we know it began formally in 1920, and following the on-air pioneering of several early stations, there was a groundswell in radio applications, culminating in what was known as the radio boom of 1922, by which time several hundred stations were on the air. But then, as experimenters came to grips with the costs of operating these stations, remember this was before the advent of commercials for sale, that fever burned out for a short time, and the station boom wasn't reignited until about 1926. With a relatively low number of stations in the early years, the Commerce Department authorized all of them to operate at 360 meters. That was 833 kilocycles. A second wavelength of 485 meters was quickly added, and before long stations were spread across the band, from the low 200 meters to 545 meters. So to begin our report, we're ready for the first of a number of dial assignments. At the beginning, everyone was assigned to 360 meters, as we said. Here are some of the more recognizable call letters from among the 378 stations that were licensed to be on the air on June 30th, 1922. And we will do them pretty much in alphabetical order, since that's the way the calls were assigned back then. KDKA, of course, was on the air. KFAB, KFAC, KFI, KFU, KGB, KGN, KGO, KGU, KGW, KGY, KHD, KHJ, and KHQ. There was KJR, KMJ, KNX, KOA, KOB, KQW, KRE, KSD, KSL, KUO, KXD, KYW. WAAF was on the air in 1922. WBAP, WBT, WBZ, WCAL, WCAR, WCAU, WDAF, WDAY, WEAF, WEW, WFAA. There was WGR, WGY, WHA, WHB, WHK, WIL, WIP, WJZ, WKY, WLB, WLW, WOC, WOI, WOR, WRR, WSB, and as we get on the line, you'd think WSM would show up here, but they weren't on the air yet. And finally, WWJ and WWL, and that's just some highlights of familiar call letters from among the 378 stations licensed in mid-1922. In the early 1920s, radio was regulated by the Commerce Department under Herbert Hoover. Hoover knew he didn't have all the answers, and so he called together industry participants and regulators for several radio conferences. The first, in 1922, tackled the onrush of applications and designated separate wavelengths based on usage. They recommended that private broadcasting and toll broadcasting, that was transmission for hire, operate on 310 meters and 435 meters. And they confirmed wavelengths for amateur, ship traffic, aircraft, and what they called government broadcasting. The proposed regulatory framework segment for public broadcasting included a recommendation that station power levels be based on a predicted service area of no more than 250 miles, and that stations on the same frequency be no closer together than 750 miles. By the way, they also recommended that there be no direct advertising permitted on radio. The first radio committee recommended but couldn't enforce. The actual laws which would govern early broadcasting assigned entertainment stations to 360 meters, 833 kilocycles, as we said, and the second wavelength, 485 meters, or 619 kilocycles, was added for stations primarily broadcasting farm news and weather. It was a tough distinction to enforce, since many stations provided both. Well, it wasn't long before the crush of applications and rising interference meant that additional wavelengths would be needed, but only a single new wavelength, 400 meters, or 750 kilocycles, was added at first. This was classified as the second entertainment wavelength, limited in power to 1,000 watts. 360 meters was now called the Class A wavelength, and 400 meters called the Class B. To give you an idea of how the assignments would pile up, here's a snapshot of station tallies in the period March 1922 to March 1923. In 1922, there were 67 total stations. Due to the radio boom, in 1923, there were 556 stations. Wavelength assignments, 360 meters. There were 52 in 1922. There were 409 on the same wavelength in 1923. Stations which broadcast both music and farm news and weather could operate on both 360 and 485 meters. In 1922, there were 13 such stations. In 1923, the number had grown to 115. There were very few stations on 485 only farm news weather stations that didn't provide entertainment. There were only two in 1922. There were only five in 1923. Well, once the 360-meter band began filling up and 400 meters was open, you saw an assignment of 10 stations in March of 1923. There were none, of course, in 1922. And the stations that operated on both 400 and 485 meters was a total of 17 in 1923. So for wavelength totals, there were 65 stations on 360 and there were 15 stations on 485. On the 400-meter band, there were no stations in 1922. A year later, in March of 1923, there were 524 stations total on the 360-meter band. There were 137 stations on 485, and there were now 27 stations operating on the new 400-meter frequency. Well, the reason that these totals don't necessarily tie off is that some stations operated on one channel, others operated on one or more, and some simulcast. The second radio conference of 1923 recommended expanding the three wavelength assignments into an actual band of wavelengths, and they proposed from the high end, 222 meters, that would be 1350 kilocycles, down to about 545 meters, or 549 kilocycles. To add further confusion, the conference also recommended three new classes of stations. This is, remember, we had the A and B momentarily for a year or so. Now we would have A, B, and C, but A wouldn't mean what A meant. Class A stations would be assigned the higher frequencies, the shorter wavelengths, from 1050 to 1350. And, dreamers they were, they suggested that where possible, each station should have its own channel. The Class A stations at the high end of the band would operate at low power levels, limited to 500 watts. Class B station assignments would be divided into 10 channels in each of five zones spread across the U.S. Because of uneven population distribution, some of these 50 channels remained vacant in the West, while in the higher population zones of the East, some channels had more than one station. The B-class stations were told they might have to share time when several stations were in the same geographical area. The December 27, 1924 Radio World says, Class B stations slated to divide time on air. Nearly every Class B broadcasting station in the country, with the exception of those on the Pacific Coast, may be required to divide time at least two ways. This prediction, made by the Radio Bureau of the Department of Commerce, is based on the expected increase of this class of station. It was believed by radio officials that the National Radio Conference had made provision for a sufficient number of new Class B channels. During the last week, however, the Radio Bureau has learned of 36 new Class B stations, either under construction or now in Classes A and C, that want to be in the higher power, lower frequency Class B assignments. In addition, the Radio Bureau knows of 20 more new Class B stations which are being contemplated. According to estimates of the Radio Bureau, within a very short time, the total number of Class B stations will be over 100. However, 13 of these stations will be located on the western coast, which will eliminate them from the congestion problem. Because of the difference in time and distance, stations on the Pacific coast use the same wavelengths as stations on the Atlantic. That's Radio World's way of saying good luck. The popular Class B stations, the forerunners of the clear channels, could operate from 500 to 1,000 watts. 1,000 watts was still the top end of practical power output. The second radio conference, remember, had come up with three new classes. Class C stations were those who elected to stay on the old 360-meter band. Stations were now to operate in what we know today as 10 kilocycle increments. Just months earlier, this would have been impractical, but new and better frequency control transmitter systems were being mandated and implemented. The stations reclassified and reassigned as Class B would follow a new table of wavelengths, and even split wavelengths. It would still be a number of years before the listening public abandoned the wavelength concept. So for convenience, we're going to call them out by frequency. Remember we said there were to be 10 channels in each of 5 zones. It didn't start that way. Class B assignments for May 1923 as follows. Zone 1, Springfield, Massachusetts, 890 WBZ. Schenectady, Troy, New York had 790, and WGY was on that channel, as well as WHAZ in Troy, New York. New York had WJZ on 660, WBAY and WEAF on 610. New York City also had on 740 WJY and WOR, as well as WDT in Stapleton, New York. In Philadelphia, 590 had WOO and WIP. 760 was WFI and WDAR. Washington had 690 reserved for the NAA in Arlington, Virginia, and also reserved 640 for the eventual use of WRC and WCAP. 4 more channels were reserved in Zone 1, 840, 940, 990, and 1040. In Zone 2, in Pittsburgh, 920 KDKA. In Chicago, 670 WMAQ and WJAZ. Davenport, Iowa, 620 WOC. Detroit had 580 WWJ and WCX. Cleveland, 770 WBAV in Columbus and WJAX in Cleveland. Cincinnati had 970 WLW and WSAI. 720 in Madison and Minneapolis was reserved for WLAG in Minneapolis. And also reserved for KYW in Chicago and WCBD in Zion was 870. In Zone 2, 2 other channels were reserved and not yet assigned. They were 820 and 1020. Zone 3 had a bunch of reservations, not a lot of assignments. 700 was assigned to WSB in Atlanta. WHAS in Louisville was on 750. WMC in Memphis on 600. 550 had KSD in St. Louis, and WCAE in Pittsburgh was reserved on 650. Also reserved and no assignments, 800, 850, 900, 950, and 1000. Moving west, Lincoln, Nebraska, 880 unassigned. 730 in Kansas City, Missouri, WDAF and WHB. Jefferson City, Missouri had 680 WOS. Dallas-Fort Worth, Texas, 630 WFAA and WBAP. San Antonio, Texas, 780 and WOAI was there. In Denver, 930 was reserved and not assigned. Omaha had WOAW on 570, and there were 3 channels reserved in the Zone 4, and they were 830, 980, and 1030. And finally, Zone 5, less populated. In Seattle, 610 was assigned at KGW in Portland. Portland itself, 660 was KDZE. Salt Lake City had an unassigned 960. San Francisco had KFDB on 590 and KPO on 710. In Los Angeles, 640 was KFI, 760 KHJ. San Diego had 560 unassigned, and 4 channels reserved in Zone 5 were 810, 860, 910, and 1010. Now, remember the Class C stations on the old 360-meter spot? That wavelength was pretty crowded, so stations sought to move to a better dial spot. So the first business of the third radio conference in 1924 was to increase the number of Class A stations as operators abandoned the old 360-meter spot. Remember, the Class A stations were assigned to the high end of the dial. If they took all the Class A stations existing and expected and added the number of Class C stations to it, there just wasn't room. So the conference expanded the Class A portion of the band from 1350 to 1500 kilocycles. Class B stations could now operate up to 5,000 watts, and there was talk of even more power. Not surprisingly, the B channels quickly filled, and so the Commerce Department assigned some of the higher power B stations to spots in the A portion of the band. And that's why today there's a group of 50 kilowatters at 1,500 and above. And that's the opening salvo in our frequency facts, centered on the early days of commercial radio operation. Looking back, it's obvious that demand from the beginning far outstripped the available radio channels. The government did react, but it seems like a better overall plan might have been realized from the very beginning and would have saved broadcasters a terrific amount of money and confusion. But that's looking back, and we want to look forward, so we'll continue our report next month, beginning in 1926, when we learn about how the QSL hobby really began from the data that was supplied by the consumer-oriented radio receiver magazines. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service. Until next month, good listening, DXers.
Thanks, Mark. Before we flip over to side 2 of the magazine, just a few news and notes popping in here. First of all, from Paul Gee, I'd like to retire Swearingen. It's official. The WTFDA, that's the Worldwide TV FM DXers Association, will be joining the National Radio Club again for its annual convention. Both the WTFDA and Decalcomania, which is the Sticker and Promo Collectors Club, will be joining us in Allentown, Pennsylvania over Labor Day weekend. It's just about the same thing as what we did back in Boise a few years ago. You know, with all the negative things about AM radio that we've heard recently, we're impressed by 930 WBEN Buffalo's uncompromising coverage of the recent tragedy in their community. Hats off to them for doing what should be done by all radio stations, serving as a community resource in the public interest. Barry Finkel has written to us and he says, with spring training about to start, please locate and send me the URLs, that's the web addresses, to Major League Baseball Radio Networks. He would like them sent to him at bsfinkel@anl.gov. Or you can just send them in written form here to the DX Audio Service and I'll pass them on to Barry. Finally, some unfilled positions. If you're looking for a job, we're still in need of some volunteers for the following positions. First of all, a DX News publisher. Paul would like to retire, so if you could help him out, please volunteer for that position. A replacement editor for the languished column The Answer Man, and one or more persons to edit future NRC publications developed by contributors or the club.
From the National Radio Club, this is the DX Audio Service.
Now let's flip over to side two of the magazine for more of the DX Audio Service for March 2009.